This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, as well as a lot of experience with the business of intelligence, is our first guest. His name is Chris Farrell. He is the Director of Investigations and Research at an absolutely indispensable organization in Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch. He has been there for quite a number of years and has been doing, well, I can only describe it as incalculably important work. And we're delighted to have a chance to review it with him from time to time. And Chris, it's been too long, so thank you for joining us today for two segments. We're very grateful.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
I want to start with work that I know you have been engaged in Judicial Watch's inimitable way, particularly the use of Freedom of Information Act requests, as well as your own investigations, into this problem that is, I believe, now front and center at last in our national policy debate about the, well, I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus. What is the nature of the work you're about, and what have you been finding concerning the provenance of this terrible disease and the pandemic that it has spawned?
Well, I think it's interesting that if you go back months and months ago, there was a concerted effort by people on the left primarily to dismiss any sort of notion that the Wuhan virus, or as you call it, the Communist Chinese virus, aptly so, by the way, that it was a lab leak, either by accidental or I'm even willing to entertain deliberate lab leak of the virus by the Chinese. That was all, you know, dismissed. It was supposed to have just sort of occurred in nature and, you know, been some random rogue, you know, bug. But now we're looking at all sorts of money being poured into the Wuhan lab. This term you hear over and over called gain of function, which basically means, hey, instead of creating things to kill bugs and germs, what happens if we tweak it? What if we play with it and, you know, do new and different things with it, right? Which is sort of the worst nightmare of bio warfare. Anyway, we do what we always do, which is file a lot of open records requests to the government, or FOIA requests. And just last week, we uncovered that Health and Human Services, over a five-year period, had dumped hundreds of thousands of dollars, nearly $1 million, into the Wuhan virology lab. And, you know, that's, Fauci was in on this because it came out of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And, you know, there's this knowledge, this guilty knowledge, in my opinion, of Dr. Fauci with regard to all sorts of international lab work, a lot of it in China, about gain of function, where they're throwing money around to have people, you know, play with various viruses and germs and diseases. And, some of the folks messing around with them are our sworn enemies, people that would love to see us collapse. And then surprise, surprise, a virus breaks out of China and throws the United States into an economic coma for 18 months.
A lot in what you've said that I'd like to follow up on, just two quick points. One is, of course, it wasn't just the media that was actively suppressing the idea that there might have been some connection between this laboratory, now I think indisputably tagged as a key element of the biological warfare program, illegal biological warfare program of China, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It was U.S. government personnel, including the man you've mentioned now several times, Tony Fauci, who turns out was actually helping underwrite this research. And another thing is, it's not just, of course, that the Chinese Communist Party would love to see us collapse. They're actively working to bring it about, as you know, Chris Farrell, through all kinds of means, including, it
Indeed.
Seems, biological
Indeed.
Warfare.
That's why there's no contradiction. And particularly when you look at the Chinese approach to their view of unrestricted warfare and sort of the long march, right? They're looking 50, 100 years down the road. You know, we can't look past the next election cycle, and they've got a very different view on their strategy.
One of the things that's interesting to me and very alarming, and you kind of alluded to it, Chris Farrell, is that it's not just that we have been supporting the biological warfare program of communist China in China through gain of function research and the like. According to one of our guests, Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin, there is an awful lot of Chinese Communist Party, Chinese People's Liberation Army scientific presence, penetration here in our own country as well. And I don't know if you're investigation has started looking into that, but this adds dramatically to the danger that we're facing, it seems to me, in terms of technology theft and you know, intellectual properties being expropriated for weapons purposes, but also probably the costs that have been incurred, the support that we've been rendering, in other words, to the people who are trying to take us down, is considerably higher than just what we've seen in the bill that has been racked up by Eco Health Systems and so on, and Tony Fauci's team in Wuhan.
Yeah, you're right. Look, the Chinese penetration of our universities, and for that matter, our national laboratories, so Lawrence Livermore, Sandia, and others, the Chinese penetration, both sort of overt and explicit, and then a little more subtle, meaning people that would apparently be just ordinary civilians, not, you know, military age males with a PhD, but instead, you know, a bright-eyed, you know, 24-year-old grad student. They're all reporting back to China. So there's the official, the people in very thin cover, you know, who's a PLA lieutenant colonel, who's actually also, you know, posing here as being sort of somebody working on a project or working at one of the labs or one of the universities when he's really reporting back to China. But likewise, youngsters, basically, who have been told, look, we'll let you go to America, but remember your family is here. And your first oath, your first obligation is to China. All of their work, all of it. I mean, don't fool yourself for 1 minute. All of their work in one form or another, the data, the information, the projects, the details, all of it is reported back to China, every last syllable of it.
And this is a matter of law. It's not just the coercion that can be done and is by the Chinese Communist Party, of course, on people's family or, you know, their possessions or what have you. There is in the national intelligence law of China, as you know, Chris Farrell, a provision, Article 7, it's called, that explicitly requires companies and individuals to support the motherland if asked to do so by the CCP. So this is part of expected to, and I suspect they don't even need to be asked most of the time. Chris, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to pick up on something that you talked about, again, sort of in passing there, namely, might this have been, in fact, a purposeful leak, not simply an accidental one, and also the counterintelligence threat that we're facing as a result of all this and more. That with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Chris Farrell, He is the director of research and investigations at famous Judicial Watch. He is one of the reasons why it is famous. His work is extraordinarily important, I think, both to our country and the cause of freedom more generally. And I couldn't be more appreciative of both what he does and the opportunity to share it with you all from time to time. Chris, you mentioned something that is tantalizing. We have gone from there's no such thing as a possible lab connection, man-made genetic engineering of the COVID-19 Wuhan CCP virus, call it what you will, to it might have had something to do with this laboratory, but it was clearly the case that it leaked accidentally, and that would have been a terrible thing for both the Chinese and for us. And clearly, lots of people did die in the aftermath in China, but vastly more elsewhere around the world, as best we can tell. But you've suggested that you're open to the idea that this may have actually been a purposeful dissemination from that laboratory, which again is associated with the biological weapons program of China. And biological weapons are being developed and prepared for use, we're told, by the Chinese for, among other purposes, depopulating the United States of America so that China might colonize it. This is out of official documentation from China. Gordon Chang, among others, has pointed to. Talk a little bit about why you think that purposeful explanation might be, in fact, what's gone on here and why that's now being widely discounted.
Well, I think you need to pause and think about, again, you have to take the Chinese view, the long term, right? The big view, not the, you know, what's the next 24-hour news cycle. And if you think about who was the single greatest game changer to the same old song with China, it was Donald J. Trump, right? Trump took a position on foreign affairs, on the economy, on tariffs, our trade relationship with the Chinese, on any number of issues or topics, policy issues with respect to China that changed what had been really pretty much the same old song, Republican or Democrat, didn't really matter. The Chinese bought Wall Street and they're complicit in the slow motion sort of managed decline of America until Trump gets into office. He changes things radically and takes the Chinese on with a whole different viewpoint. Well, how do you destroy Trump? How do you put America back on its heels economically? And how do you reopen the door to us sliding back into the same old Chinese appeasement, slow motion decline of America, where we sell off our manufacturing base and Wall Street continues to be, you know, slaves of their communist Chinese masters? Well, you destroy the economy, you blame it on Trump, you have a complicit Democratic party and media that's willing to jump on board and obviously bash the sitting president because they want to put their guy in, and look what happened. And so one way to economically and politically cripple the United States, or at least put us into sort of a coma for a while, is to have a pandemic release.
At the very least, Chris.
Chinese aren't too worried about their own population. And number two, should, 98% of people who get the disease come out on the other end just fine, but it terrifies the population.
And was used.
And so all of this lines up.
Yeah, was used by political enemies of Donald Trump here in the United States, let's be clear, for the purpose of maximizing the pain and dislocation and trauma, to be sure. Chris, one thing that has been bruited of late, and it's, consistent with, I think, that thesis you've just propounded, is something called Event 201 that was a wargaming exercise, basically, a tabletop exercise in New York City, I believe in October of 2019, in which a coronavirus pandemic was gamed in terms of how great a help it would be to promoting world government and, essentially, among other things, the globalist and communist agendas. And I just have to tell you, whether it's the plandemic, as some have called it, or whether that was just an extraordinary coincidence, it does seem to me it behooves us to look much more closely at the possible explanation you've just put forward in terms of why we've been afflicted in this way. Let me pivot to one other thing, Chris, because in addition to your long and distinguished service at Judicial Watch, you had a previous career with the United States Army in which you specialized in what now seems to be really a lost art. And to the great detriment of our country, we no longer seem to take seriously, let alone apply intensive resources to a problem that, again, you kind of alluded to in your earlier comments, namely the counterintelligence threat we're facing from the deep penetration of the Chinese Communist Party into our academic institutions, yes, and into our laboratories and into our government, our political elite, and Hollywood, and you know, our economy on Wall Street, and on and on and on. Give us a quick sense, if you could, especially when you hear people like Xi Van Fleet, who stood up initially in the Loudoun County School Board and said, I am a victim, I am a survivor, I am a veteran of the Chinese Communist Party's malevolent activities, in this case, the Cultural Revolution. We're watching it play out here in our own country, notably with this critical race theory stuff. So that's a sweeping question, but when you're looking at what's happening to the military in terms of subjecting our troops to critical race theory, as it's called, or subjecting our children to it, it all seems to be part and parcel of this larger, as you say, unrestricted warfare against our country. And do we have in the FBI or in Homeland Security or in any other branch of our government a robust counterintelligence operation underway to protect us against it?
The short answer is no, we don't. There was a time when people in the United States government got up and went to work every day with the goal, the specific goal of defeating communism. Now, those days are over. There's no one out there who gets up in the morning and says, okay, I need to get to work and not just push back or roll back communism. I want to defeat communism. Instead, we have people going to work today actually advancing communist causes. This nonsense of critical race theory is just one component of critical theory itself, which, you know, your listeners who aren't familiar with the Frankfurt School can go and do some reading on that with cultural Marxism and what their goals are. There was a time when that was just sort of a notion or like a goal of the left. Now it is being actively implemented. The woman you spoke about who went through the Cultural Revolution in China, you know, all of those sort of vague threats of what the left could do, they're doing, right? You can look at Commissar Kamala Harris. Lord forbid she become president. We won't recognize this country. You know, the threat is grave. It's there's people who have been lulled to, you know, believe that all the goals of the critical theory, you know, that socialism is kind of a cool experiment and, gee, it might work. I'd like to say basically everyone sort of 35 and less is or junior is in trouble.
Well, and this is in part because they have already been indoctrinated, many of them, with some of this enthusiasm for socialism, if not the full-on, I call it communist racist training rather than critical race theory. And Chris, let me just ask you, because again, from the perspective of a counterintelligence professional, from the perspective of a veteran, it must be particularly alarming to you what is being done at the behest of the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, to use these Marxist techniques, cultural Marxist techniques, as Xi Van Fleet calls it, to purge the military of patriots on the grounds that they are somehow extremists.
Under Obama, I mean, part of the problem is the entire general officer, the flag officers in the Pentagon, generals and admirals, going back to 2008, so carrying that forward, so now, you know, 13, 14 years later, the entire leadership of the Pentagon, they're all Obama generals, right? They're all guys who, when they were told, hey, listen, we're going to encourage people, we're going to have a guy named Ralph show up and wear a skirt and say that his name is Karen, and everyone's going to go, oh, okay, no problem. the guys who engaged in the crazy social engineering experiments of the Obama era, which are now back in full force, they all shrugged and said, okay, no problem. Those are the flag officers of the Pentagon. They're complicit. And so when you have an entire officer corps at that level, who are what I refer to as the Obama generals, and you have Lloyd Austin, who's one of them, now converted over to be Secretary of Defense, can anyone be surprised? I mean, really?
Well, I'm not so sure that anyone who's been paying attention can be surprised. But I think what we really are getting at here, and I, again, appreciate, as always, Chris Farrell, the clarity that you bring to these issues, as well as the hard experience. I think an awful lot of Americans were completely unaware of how far along we are in this, cultural revolution, for want of a better term.
There was a lot of litmus tests. Policy stuff that was done with senior field grade officers back in the last 15 years. If you were a light colonel or full colonel looking to general, if you didn't get on board and play ball with all the social engineering nonsense, if you weren't open to all the crazy social theories of the left, you knew your career was done. And I can give you countless scores of people that I know who were essentially told, you're done, go retire, because they weren't willing to jump on board with the lefty view of things.
And those are, of course, precisely the people you want in the United States military, it seems to me. And this is the point of the exercise, is to get them out and to sort of repopulate it with people who will go with along with this program. Support and defend not the Constitution, as our oath of office has told us we must, Chris, but support and defend the revolution. Exactly right. Chris, this is a subject to which we will return, I hope, with you very soon. Thank you for your time today and the extended opportunity to visit with you. It's really appreciated. And thanks also again for what you do at Judicial Watch. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll talk with you very soon. Next up, we will talk with Robert Spencer about his take on critical race theory and how Islamists are at work in this anti-American revolution as well.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by one of the most brilliant men I know, certainly one of the most impactful in terms of the contribution he's making in the public policy space, specifically that part of it that involves a very formidable challenge that we face from our ideological adversaries. He's primarily been concerned with, of late, the Sharia supremacists, as I think of them. But before we get to that, I do want to talk with Robert Spencer, the director of a fabulous outfit, Jihad Watch, and a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of 21 books, several more in the works, and one of them, most recent of which is a book he published for the Center for Security Policy Press, Mass Migration in Europe, a Model for the U.S. I want to speak, though, to you, Robert, about critical race theory, a topic we've been touching on now throughout the program. You've written powerfully about its incompatibility, well, I would say with Western civilization in general, but with Christianity as well. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, you're absolutely right, Frank. It is incompatible with Western civilization, and that's because Western civilization is, to a tremendous degree, more than people realize, based on the Judeo-Christian idea of the evil in the world coming from within every individual. There's no one who is perfect or sinless or untainted, and consequently, it is impossible and wrong to point the finger at any one particular group and say they're the problem, they're the source of all the difficulties in the world. And yet that's what we're seeing with critical race theory, an increasing acceptance in the mainstream of the most open and blatant unapologetic racism against white people in the guise of opposing white people's supposed racism. And while I'm sure there are white people who are still racist, the reality is that this is not going to be any different from the racism that has historically oppressed non-white people in the United States in the past. It's going to end up with the same kind of injustices. And the churches ought to be out in the forefront of condemning this idea as being fundamentally unchristian and against this understanding of the nature and derivation of the evil that is in the world.
Well, at the minimum, it is very much at odds with our Constitution and the freedoms that it enshrines. And yet, as you say, Robert, it has become this so-called critical race theory, a de facto official religion of the United States government. We're seeing it being pushed relentlessly, both inside the government, notably, as we've talked about with Chris Farrell, inside the military, and now in schools across the country, not just on college campuses, but down in K through 12. This official religion, as you've described it, is something that is clearly a threat to the church itself, is it not? And therefore, as you ask, why isn't the church standing up in opposition to it? Do you have an answer?
Well, I think that the churches have all given up the idea that they should be opposing any ideas that are inimical to its own teaching, to their own teaching. It's kind of strange because throughout history, the church has been at the forefront of that kind of activity of defining itself, defining what it believes and what it does not believe, rejecting heresies and so on. But all that's sort of gone out of fashion. And I've been dismayed, really, Frank, in all seriousness. I've been studying these things for so many decades, and I remember first learning about the Nation of Islam in the 1970s and 80s and thinking how strange it was that they had this crude racist theory that the white man is the devil and so on. And that's really essentially, if you want to sum up what critical race theory is, that's really it. And that's being, as you noted, being taught in the schools by the sponsored by the government and so on. It's as if the Nation of Islam has become the official religion of the United States.
It's chilling, and it does need to be resisted at every level. And I think those of us who are involved in the faith community and trying to protect against what is becoming even here a greater problem, which is the persecution of not just Jews, but of Christians as well, commands us to stand up against this, de facto religion, if you will, this cultural Marxism, I think is a better way to characterize it, because at the end of the day, it's the antithesis of what we think of as religious. It is, as in communism, the oppression of the state under the guise of fidelity to the most extreme of ideologies. And so I salute you for calling this out, Robert, and I know this is a little out of area for you, but it's really vital that you've done so. Let me turn to some of the things that are in your area of expertise in particular, Robert, and that is we have been seeing once again this notion that among other terrible things that white people, I guess, principally are charged with doing is engaging in Islamophobia. How is that manifesting itself here in the United States? I've been hearing evidence of the tie-in between the Muslim Brotherhood, which has made a cottage industry of decrying this so-called horrific strain of white supremacism, is getting very actively engaged in the sort of revolution that is principally associated with the left. What can you tell us about those strains of what we're confronting at the moment?
Well, you have the Squad, and of course, two of the Squad members are the two Muslim congresswomen in the House of Representatives, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, and they are following what is essentially the line of the Brotherhood organizations in the United States and aiding these groups to bring their people into positions of power and influence. Biden, during the campaign, promised that he would have Muslims at every level of his administration, and he did so addressing a Muslim Brotherhood-linked group. And all that means is that he's essentially going to be placing Muslim Brotherhood operatives in various places in the U.S. government, as we see with Hadi Amer, who is one of his people dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, somebody who has endorsed the Palestinian jihad, called for intifada and so on. And so this kind of influence, this is the time, this is their moment, even more than in the Obama administration. And the Brotherhood-linked groups in the United States, the Council on American-Islamic Relations and others, are seeing that this is their chance to really gain a stranglehold over American policy, and they're doing everything they can to achieve that.
One of the facets of this, too, is the not just the decrying of the so-called Islamophobic types, but and by the way, folks, that is a made-up term. I don't believe there's any evidence that there is some widespread intolerance towards Muslims. Having been accused of it myself, I can tell you it is part and parcel of a political warfare strategy for canceling people who actually point out, as Robert Spencer does better than anybody, the true nature of Sharia supremacism and its jihad. And this, I think, should be understood as just part of an effort to make us more vulnerable to that that agenda. But Robert, the other piece of this has been, you know, lifting up people who are pro-Islamist. And you mentioned a documentary film about a New Jersey mayor who is credited with fighting Islamophobia and otherwise promoting what basically the Muslim Brotherhood is about. Tell us about him and this film, if you would.
Yeah, this is Mohammed Kerula, who is the mayor of Prospect Park, New Jersey. And he's the subject of a new, very adoring, fawning documentary film called Mayor Mohammed, that has just premiered at the Brooklyn Film Festival, and he's being lionized in the film. The film is being lionized as being a courageous strike against the forces of Islamophobia, which he supposedly is combating. Now, what's uncomfortable about this, what's disturbing about this, is that Mohammed Kerula made frequent travel to the Syrian war zone, and he repeatedly expressed support for Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria. He even thanked ISIS for taking bandits off the streets in Syria. And so this is somebody who clearly has sympathy for, and maybe worse, ties with jihad groups in Syria. And so this problem with lionizing him in this way, with this documentary film, is that it disarms anyone who would criticize him or call attention to those connections with the jihad groups in Syria. They're just bigoted, racist Islamophobes. And now this idea is being advanced. And so who knows what Mohammed Kerula is really up to? And we probably never will know, because no investigators will dare to bring the opprobrium of the general culture upon themselves and get this stigma of being called Islamophobia by investigating it.
Well, we can tell people that it's no fun to be branded in that fashion, but it is important to stand up to what is fundamentally, as is the Marxist effort about taking down our country. And I'm proud of doing that myself, and I know you are, and you deserve great credit for the help you give all the rest of us to understand what the stakes are. Thank you, Robert Spencer, for joining us today and for the work you do, not least at the Center for Security Policy, where you are one of our senior fellows, for which I'm also very grateful. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon, if you would.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of our favorite guests. His name is Todd Bensman. He is a national security fellow with a terrific organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He brings to that role a wealth of experience as a journalist, an investigative journalist of great renown, as a former official in the Texas Department of Public Safety, and now, of course, as one of the most thoughtful and highly regarded commentators on what is going on with respect to our insecure border and the ripple effect that is having, thanks to the policies of the Biden-Harris administration, on, well, every city and town across America, not just border communities and states. His name is, as I say, Todd Bensman. He is also the author of America's Covert Border War, a best-selling book that I strongly commend to you all. Todd, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Frank.
I mentioned the Biden-Harris administration. The Harris part of the team has been much in the news this week, and much of it not very complimentary to Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, for how she was received and what she did in the course of her travels to ferret out the root causes, as she's fond of putting it, of our border crisis. Talk a little bit about what you've made of her exploits this week and what it might mean for our policy in this area.
Like anybody else who has been paying attention, who was watching the Democratic primary campaign, the debate, I saw Kamala Harris promise wide open borders, talk about ending deportation, talk about decriminalizing illegal entry, and raise her hand when it comes to offering free health care to anyone who comes over the border and wants it. And then we saw her down in Guatemala saying things like, don't come, don't come. So I think her credibility is shot. I think everybody sees her as a phony. And I think that undermines American credibility to be able to have an authority to ask other countries to do things for us. So that's number one. Number two is the whole notion of, you know, addressing root causes is akin to nation building. And I think the notion of nation building is discredited, at least since the Vietnam War. We don't do very well at nation building. And lastly, Kamala Harris clearly doesn't understand that huge numbers of immigrants hitting the southern border are not from the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. They're coming from all over the world. Think Haiti and Cuba. And so what are we supposed to do? Nation build Haiti and Cuba? I think we dismissed that idea a long time ago. The whole thing, the whole enterprise is absurd.
It's absurd and dangerously so, as it unfortunately is taking our eye off the real problem, course, which is what the Biden-Harris administration has done with its policies. And this was pointed out to her, as I understand it, by a number of her interlocutors during her travels. And the other piece of this, Todd, which I'd say somewhat facetiously, I guess, but not really, is that the one thing that one can credit Joe Biden and Kamala Harris with trying to do that could conceivably address at least one of the root causes of this crisis, namely the attractiveness of the United States as a place to migrate to, is what they're doing to our economy, and to our political system, and to the country more generally. But I'm fearful that that's probably not going to dissuade people from heading north, even so. But let me turn to this other piece that you've identified in a forthcoming article that touches on something that you've reported on previously, and that is the extent to which among those coming in are not only large numbers of people who aren't from our own hemisphere, aren't from the countries that we've been told are in need of overhaul, namely Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, Mexico, I guess, but rather that we are dealing with a lot of countries that have very considerable numbers of people who wish to do us harm in them. Two of them were apprehended, as you pointed out at the time, back in April, I believe it was, from Yemen, were wanted for terrorism-related charges and precluded from flying into the United States. Tell us about that story, if you would, and what Congressman Tom Tiffany of Wisconsin got out of Christopher Wray when he broached the issue with him yesterday.
Sure. On April 5th, just a couple of months ago now, U.S. Customs and Border Protection issued this press release that two Yemenis were apprehended at the border who are on the FBI's terrorism watch list. That thing lasted all of one day. It was taken down and removed. And American journalists never asked about it and have never said a peep about it in the 2 months since. Then yesterday, all of a sudden, Congressman Tom Tiffany out of Wisconsin, who just went to the Darien Gap in Panama through which these two Yemenis traveled, had FBI Director Christopher Wray in front of him and asked him about it. First time anybody has asked about this thing in a public forum or at all about who, like for an update, what happened to the two Yemenis. And of course, you know, Wray couldn't or didn't say anything about, you know, the investigation, but he did acknowledge that there was an investigation of these two Yemenis. And he also acknowledged that there is a terrorism threat related to the border. So I would hope that other congressmen and officials and maybe people in the media, legacy media, can now ask about this and be aware of it.
I certainly hope so, too. And I want to thank you for the diligent efforts you've been making to call attention to not just this particular episode, but the macro problem, which of course is very much central to your book, America's Covert Border War, and how we're trying, or at least have in the past, been trying to prevent terrorists from getting across this border, this porous border of ours. You are, of course, based in Texas. One piece of news out just today is that your governor has indicated he intends to try to complete Donald Trump's border wall across the Texas border with Mexico. Do you anticipate that that will be, in fact, forthcoming? And if so, how much of a difference do you think it might make in the challenge that we're now facing? Todd Bensman.
This is a really unusual proposal. I think some people were expecting this. I'd been hearing about it, that there were negotiations underway. I think that it is night and day if he can manage to get that wall constructed. My understanding is that it's going to be pretty expensive for a state to handle on its own, maybe $8 or $10 billion to put that thing up, 400 miles of it in Texas. Texas is a big state with a big budget. I'm sure they can get it started. It's going to take private landowners whose land abuts the river Rio Grande, who give permission, and I think they have a lot of permission. So I actually think that they will get this thing started. Keep in mind that Abbott is in an election mode, so there's probably some politics behind that. He's got primary campaign challengers who have been talking about building that Texas should build the wall too. But I think it's a great idea. I think Border Patrol agents absolutely, you know, believe in that wall, and I believe in that wall too. I think it absolutely works in conjunction with patrolling.
I do too, and I hope you're right that Greg Abbott will move forward with it and not simply be engaging in a little bit of political theater for our benefit. One last thing very quickly. We've only got 40 seconds. The Darien Gap is something you mentioned. I really commend the Congressman Tom Tiffany for actually going down and checking it out himself. You've been down in this neck of the woods. Michael Yon has reported from it as well. This is prime territory, of course, for the conduit of people coming up. Is there anything that can be done to secure it?
There are a few things. One thing is to keep in mind is the new CBP apprehension numbers are out, and we've seen 30 times as many foreign nationals come through the Darien Gap in the last month than in the prior year. It's a 750% increase. There is a wave of humanity coming through that gap right now, lured by the Biden invitation to come over the border. Lots of pregnant women and children, total tractor beam going on there. One thing that could be done right away is to have Panama start deportation instead of busing, and Costa Rica as well. I'll be headed down there in about 10 days myself, so stay tuned.
We will stay tuned. Thank you so much, Todd Bensman, for what you do with your updates here and elsewhere, and the great work at the Center for Immigration Studies. I know you keep it up, and congratulations again on America's Covert Border War. Please check it out, folks. We'll talk with you again very soon. Thank you, Todd. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.